Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Welcome to NPR News Presents. I'm Stephen John. This hour, you'll hear the fourth program in this fall's Talking Volumes series. Author Ann Patchett joined NPR's Carrie Miller on the stage of the Fitzgerald Theater last week to talk about her latest book titled Commonwealth, though as we'll hear, the book barely comes up in the midst of a wide-ranging conversation about other great books. That conversation comes naturally to Ann Patchett because she also owns a bookstore in Nashville. It's called Parnassus Books. Here's Carrie Miller.
Do you ever recommend your own novels at the bookstore?
No.
Why?
Because I went to Catholic school for 12 years. I don't know. Actually, I have a great story. I was in the store. This was a few months ago. It was before Commonwealth came out. And I was there for a meeting early in the morning, and I opened the front door, which I don't normally do in the morning. And a hipster couple came in, very attractive young people in their early 20s with artfully torn T-shirts.
I was going to say, you knew they were hipster how?
Don't you know, Carrie? Don't you know? There's
like one
t-shirts. Piercing too many and very distressed boots. And the hipster boy says to the hipster girl, "Oh, look, Ann Patchett has her own novel in the window." And I'm holding the door open. And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't do the window displays. I didn't realize it was there. I'll take it out." And he said, "Well, I don't care." And I said, "Well, I'm Ann Patchett. I don't want you to feel uncomfortable in the bookstore."
What did they buy?
I don't think they stayed very long.
You wrote something in the Washington Post about the way we share books and the way we recommend that made me think differently about the word of mouth and the power of what you call in the book business hand selling.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But what we who are not bookstore owners just talk about something we love and that we want a friend to have the experience of reading that. So you said, no matter how much we love a book, the experience of reading isn't complete until we give it to someone who will love it as much as we do. I was thinking, reading is such a solitary experience. You're right. It is complete when you can pass that book on and know that you're sharing something that has been really meaningful to you.
Well, and also, it's kind of two levels. There's the person who just loves a book and will give it to everyone because they love the book. But then there is the next level, which is actually matchmaking, where you say, "This is the book for you. I know you. I know what you read, and I know what you love, and I know that you're going to want this book." And that is a particularly beautiful thing, because then you're also making the person feel very known.
That's like book chemistry.
It is.
Right?
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Has owning a bookstore changed you as a writer, too?
Owning a bookstore has changed me as a writer. In a lot of subtle ways. It used to be that when I went on book tour and bookstore owners would say to me, "Thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Ann Patchett, for coming to our store." I thought they were just being super polite. And now I realize that what they're saying is, "Tonight you made us enough money to make payroll and pay the rent." And that really, it's true. It's the visiting authors that are such an infusion of sales. And it's why I go on endless book tours, because I really have such an understanding now that I am supporting the booksellers. So that has part of it. The other part of it is, I used to say that I write the book that I want to read, mm-hmm. and now I feel like I write the book I want to sell, or the book that I feel is missing in the store.
Oh, wow.
And while there are lots and lots of wonderful, well-written novels about family, I never found a book in my store that portrayed family that was as complicated as mine and as the families of my friends. So I wanted a really big, sprawling family novel that I could sell. Yeah.
Wow. You know, that's not the answer that I expected. I want to write the book that I can sell because it's missing. I didn't think there was anything really missing out there. There's a new way to tell the story.
There is a new way to tell the story, going back to Hamilton. Yeah. But there are some things that you think everyone I know is having some variation of this experience of having parents, aging parents, but plus aging step-parents and step-siblings and siblings and people who are in your family and out of your family. And the complexity, and it's not like a bad complexity, but the big messiness that I think is modern family isn't something that I was seeing in a book. When I read a book about family and people getting divorced, it's an only child marrying an only child and having one child.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, it's just not my experience.
Are there any classic novels about family, not in the size and the complexity that you're talking about in yours, but that have been influential in the way you think about how to tell a story of family?
The Stone Diaries by Carol Shields, which is a book that I love that book. And I read it again, and it really holds up. It's interesting, too, because they reissued that book. For those of you who read The Stone Diaries when it came out, you remember it had those old black and white photographs, which I never felt worked all that well. And the new edition of that book, they don't have the photographs in it anymore. But that is a book that is a birth-to-death novel,
mm-hmm.
and it covers so much time in one character's life, and it really showed me a lot about how to move through a lot of time and a lot of people and have those big gaps in between that the reader would be able to fill in. It was a great example.
Someone reminded me when I was out in the audience a few minutes ago about the Jane Smiley conversation we had. That was wild. Was there anybody here for Jane Smiley besides, yeah. Do you know her?
She's so smart.
She's a character,
She is
too.
Scorching smart. Yes, she is a character. She is a scorching smart character and a really good writer.
So she tells what is a complicated and messy story in this series.
In three volumes.
Right. In three volumes.
Right.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
She's taken on kind of this idea that you have, but she did have to divide it.
And, you know, as a bookseller, I was floored that she did that.
Why?
Because if you didn't read book one, you're not going to read book two.
But you could.
But you could. But there's so many books coming out. Books are like this rushing tide that is bearing down on me all the time. And I find with a series, if I miss book one, it's kind of like, well, that's it. I'm done, because I'm just swimming through all the other books that are coming at me.
You know, I do feel the same way, and yet look at someone like Elena Ferrante.
Okay, that's a great example, and I loved those books, but I read them all together. I didn't read them as they were coming out. I read all of them in about 10 days.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, without doing anything else. It was like, you know, walk, 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 and then you go down the open manhole. And so many people had been telling me for so long, you've got to read the Ferrante. And I didn't do it. So by the time I finally got going on it, I just read them all at once. It was the equivalent of binge watching an HBO series.
How do you think that changed the experience of understanding those novels?
The other books that were like this for me were the Patrick Melrose novels of Edward St. Albans, which I love.
We talked about this
last
time you were here.
And I read them all at once.
Right.
And the Patrick Melrose novels were particularly unsatisfying in terms of endings. I mean, they just, you got to the end of one and you turned the next page and you were on the beginning of the next one, and as it should be. They needed, to my mind, to be read as a whole. It would have been incredibly frustrating for me to have to wait 3 years in between volumes two and three. And I felt the same way about the Ferrante. And when I sell the Ferrante, when someone comes in and buys My Brilliant Friend, I always say, buy the second book now. If you don't like the first book, fine, bring the second book back or bring them both back. But you are going to finish that first book at 11 o'clock at night, and you are going to have the second book. And with all of those books, I finished, but then I immediately read the first 25 pages of the next one.
What do you think about what she says about the idea of letting the novels stand on their own and being in no way connected to? I mean, it's the opposite of what we're doing tonight and what you've been doing for the last 6 weeks.
I love her, and I respect her, and I just think that it's brilliant. I'm so happy that she did it the way she did it. I'm so glad that that exists as a model. I wish I could do my life over again and be Elena Ferrante. But, you know, once you're out, you're out. But it was really funny. This was just whenever this news came out. So it was while I was on tour. It just happened. And I got a call from On Point. And they were having a group discussion about Elena Ferrante being outed.
Right.
And they said, we've read that you really like those Ferrante novels, so will you be on the show? And I said, of course I won't be on the show. I mean, I am enraged that anyone outed her. Why would I want to out her further by discussing how I feel about outing her? She deserves her privacy. She wants her privacy. She's not baiting anybody with it. I don't think that there's any ploy in saying, no, I want to be left alone.
No.
I think she really wanted to be left alone and was doing no harm by being left alone.
But what do you think about the idea behind her not being connected to the novels, that they are better to stand on their own and not in any way be shadowed or influenced by what we need to know about her?
I agree with that.
Do you?
I absolutely agree with that. I don't think it's the way the modern machine works, but yes, I think that art should certainly be able to rise and fall on its own, and it would be better, because this is the thing about literary fiction. I bring half, and you bring half. There are huge holes in my book, in her book. You need to bring your imagination, your baggage to the novel to fill it out, to create it. So if you have the author present, if you have me here on this stage, you, the audience, think that I have the right answer, or that the book is about me, or that I'm going to give you some key that will give you a better understanding of the book, when in fact, every single thing I've got, everything that's good and interesting and smart about me is in this book. Everything I have to say about this book is in this book. I am at this point a distraction. What am I doing here? I don't know.
This is so interesting to hear you say this, because the way the book was promoted to us, and we're going to talk about this, was, while it is not autobiographical.
It is.
It is autobiographical.
It is, and it's not.
Right?
Yeah,
it is
absolutely
your most personal novel.
Right.
So how interesting to hear you say, I don't really have anything to add to this.
And I'm happy to add things. I mean, I'm
And
happy.
I'm glad you are happy,
happy to
add
be
things.
Here. And I'm happy to talk about it. But if you're talking about the perfect world for a piece of art, for example, I have this experience, and I bet you do too, of from time to time getting to read a novel that is not even in a galley, that is just a stack of paper.
Mm-hmm.
I got to read J.K. Rowling's book, A Casual Vacancy. This is such a great story. I have never read the Harry Potter books. I don't have children. I just missed that whole thing.
I haven't either, and I get hate mail every time
I
read it.
Wow.
No, I never
Solidarity.
Have.
Solidarity.
Yeah.
Okay. So
finally, someone else.
When The Casual Vacancy came out, or was about to come out, it was her first non-Harry Potter book, her first book for grown-ups. And she was going to do exactly one stop for book tour And they wanted me, they being her publisher, Little Brown, wanted me to interview her on stage at Lincoln Center.
Oh.
And I said, oh. I said, that's lovely, but I am not going to back read 4,000 pages of Harry Potter. I just don't have time. And they said, no, no, we would rather that you just come at this on its own terms as a book. They had a human being fly this manuscript from New York to Nashville.
Wow.
In a sealed box. And I had to sign papers. And I got it for a week saying that I wouldn't divulge, I wouldn't Xerox. And then the human flew back and took the box away from me. So I had this experience of being on my couch with this 600 pages of paper, however long it was a big book. I didn't know one thing about it. I had not read Harry Potter. I wasn't judging it against everything. And I read this book. I loved that book. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And then the jacket copy came, and the cover came, and the reviews came, and it got bad reviews. Utterly a mystery to me, because I could read that book. What a gift to be able to read a Joe Rowling book without any preconceived ideas about her or what it should be or what it had to live up to. I also read The Goldfinch in the same way.
Wow.
Donna Tartt is a friend of mine, and she emailed me. You want to talk about a big email file? She emailed me that book, and she kept saying, wait for the galley, wait for the galley. I don't want you to read it before the galley. And then I got this horrible cold, and it was about 2 weeks before the galley was coming out, and I called her up, and I said, it's now, right now. I'm on the couch. I cannot sit up. Now is the moment that I need to read your giant book. And she emailed it, and I printed it. I didn't have one clue what it was about, even though she's one of my very best friends. She doesn't talk about it. And I read that book in 2.5 days. And it was a sacred experience. So all going back to Elena Ferrante,
right,
and saying, even with these two incredibly famous people, Joe Rowling and Donna Tartt, I was able to read those books just as they were, with no input from the author, from the media, from the publicist. And it is a better experience.
Do you feel like we, the readers of Commonwealth, that we'd have a different experience, that we would maybe draw different conclusions if we weren't influenced by the knowledge that it's as close to you as any of the other novels you've written, right? Is that true? Let me ask you that.
But roll it back. You're influenced by the cover. Guess what, folks? We judge books by their covers. I own a bookstore. I can't tell you the extent to which I judge books by their covers. By being able to see a book from across the room, I love this cover.
Do you? The cover says nothing to me. It says oranges on a tree, California?
Oranges on a tree, California, but also paper cutouts. It says something maybe about childhood, about simplicity. I looked at 30 different covers. I'm crazy about this cover. But there you go. That's a perfect example. Somebody's going to love it. Somebody's going to hate it. The title, I mean, we just automatically start putting together our position about the package before we get to the art. And by saying this is my most autobiographical novel, that's a great way to market something.
It is.
It's a great way to do interviews all day long.
Exactly.
And I interview people about their books, and so I know that if somebody says to me, this is an autobiographical novel, I'm like, woo-hoo, I know what I'll talk about.
All right. What would your question be to you?
What
about that?
What would my question be to me?
Yeah.
Anne Patchett, how did you manage to leave so much out?
Ah, it's a good question.
And again, how having a bookstore influences me. I am weary I grow weary of the 700- and 800-page novel. If a book is 800 pages, it really needs to be Anna Karenina for me. And so I think that what I did in this book was I showed enormous restraint because the book has these tentacles and right. It just goes in every direction. And it could have been 1,800 pages. It totally could have been a trilogy. But at every moment I said to myself, okay, what's the least amount that I can tell and trust that the reader will be able to fill it in and figure it out?
Simply because
there's too much to read. There are too many demands on our time. And I don't need to show off. You don't need to read my writing just because it's great. And, oh, I could name some names.
We're all friends. Go ahead.
What is this, a microphone? I can think of some writers who are amazing writers, just write sentences I could never even aspire to. And you read a 40-page scene, and it has nothing to do with anything in the book. But it's just wonderful writing. I don't do that. I come from a magazine journalism background, right. And I am aware of how many words I'm putting down, and I am aware of your time. It's just my way.
I think at this stage of your career, with the kind of trust that we readers have in you, you could show off. I'd be okay with that.
I wouldn't.
Maybe I want that.
Well, maybe you
I
do.
Want Anne to show me it. Exactly what she can.
If you want show off, I can give you a reading list at the end of the evening.
Okay.
What pulls you back from that? Aside from I'm not going to put an 800-page novel out there.
And you know, it's funny because I just referenced two very long books that I love. And
you did.
I did. I loved The Casual Vacancy, and I loved The Goldfinch. So it is not an across-the-board dislike of long books, but it's just with that feeling of so many books that I have to read. A book has got to be great. I will read a mediocre 300-page book all the way to the end, but I will not read a mediocre 700-page book all the way to the end.
Why do you keep going in a mediocre 300-page book?
Usually because I know the person who wrote it.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that funny or is that true?
It's true. I am very quick to quit.
Yeah.
Probably at least three new books present themselves every day in my life that I need to read. It's insane. I'll tell you what, if I open the packages right back to the editor saying politely that I'm not going to read the book, find a home for that book and recycle responsibly the packaging materials, I feel that it's been a total victory without my ever having cracked the spine. So I do finish books that I don't love if someone I love has told me they love that book, if you follow that. I mean, there are people that I really respect, and if they say, this book was amazing, I will stay with it much, much longer. I just bailed out in the middle of a long book recently because I had four different people that I really respected tell me that the book was terrific. I had started it, stopped. They said, no, this is an amazing book. And I went back and read 300 pages of it and could go no farther.
I always question myself in those situations. Do you?
No.
No, you don't?
No. No, there's nothing to
You're
question.
A better woman than
no,
I am,
No,
clearly.
You know what? Because I'm not passing judgment on the book. I'm not saying this is a bad book.
That's how I feel.
This is a book that is not to my taste. I mean, I do know a bad book. I know a bad book, and I'll bail on a bad book in a page. But if it is, there are a lot of books that I will say, this is well written, this is smart, this is interesting, this is not my thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no judgment in that other than it's just not my thing.
How have your tastes changed on what your thing is?
I'm so glad you asked that question. So Parnassus has been open. It will be 5 years in a couple of weeks.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
No, that's terrific.
Before we open the store, I read Henry James. I have read The Awkward Age 3 times. I could just read James over and over again. I would read maybe 6 contemporary novels a year, and I read all over the place. Now, there is a great reading exercise on a website called LitHub, and it's the Read Harder Challenge. Do you know this?
Yeah.
Like 25 questions. Read a book over 500 pages, under 100 pages. Listen to a book that won an Audi Award. Read the first book in a series written by a person of color. Read a horror novel. Read a book by or about a transgendered person. I nailed it. Like, I just had all 25. Because owning a bookstore makes me read so far outside of my comfort zone. I just finished an amazing book that to say I would never have read without a bookstore, Who Killed These Girls by Beverly Lowry, came out on Tuesday. Anybody interested in true crime, and a lot of people are, this book was brilliant. This book was so well written, and it was about the yogurt shop murders in Austin, Texas in 1991, and about false confession. It's really a book about false confession and the whole psychological ramification of that and what happened to these people in this case. There isn't a shred of game in this book, of sentimentality. Nothing is sensationalized. It's just a hard, complicated story, beautifully, cleanly told. That's the kind of book that I'm like, oh, look, I own a bookstore. I'm reading Who Killed These Girls.
You would have never picked, you're saying you would
I
not
would
have
never
picked that
have
up.
Picked that up. The book that I always think of was the real turning point for me was we have a first editions club, so we're always reading 4 months in advance to find the book that we're going to pick. What's going to be the November book? What's going to be the March book? And we kind of have assignments, who's got to read what book. And I was up to read Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel.
So good.
So good. But it's post-apocalyptic. I have never read a post-apocalyptic book, nor had I any interest. I was thought I would pass out of this life never having read a post-apocalyptic book. And they said, nope, you're up. You've got to read it. It's your turn. And it was one of my favorite books
terrific.
Of the year. Ben Winter's Underground Airlines, which is a book that takes place in a parallel present-day United States. Another great example of a book that I never would have read. But the sales rep came and was saying, this is a brilliant book. That's someone I trust. I'll read that book. It blew me away.
This is so much fun to talk books with you like
this.
Wow.
And boy, for those of you who don't have a ticket to see Colson Whitehead, Underground Railroad, that's it. That's the book of the year. That's your Pulitzer right there.
When was the last time a novel changed your mind about something you thought you thought?
Ben Winter's Underground Airlines.
You changed
the way,
quick of an answer to
changed
that.
The way I looked at the world. And again, what was interesting is the person who gave me that book in the store said, you know, read this book. And we talked about it a lot. That was a book that I walked down the street after I read that book and I saw the world in a different
way.
Really? Yeah. It really took my breath away. Anybody out there having read that book? Yeah. How'd it go for you? Thumbs up. Yeah.
You saw the world in a different way.
Yeah, I really did.
Wow.
I really, really did. It changed me. That book changed me.
I had an experience like that reading The Age of Innocence again recently. And hearing you say that about Henry James, didn't you go back to those classics because you thought there's some maybe unexplored cranny here, or there's some new revelation waiting again in this classic when you are so familiar with them?
You know, there aren't a lot of books that I reread, but Henry James is very hard. and especially the late novels, The Ambassadors, Wings of the Dove, Golden Bowl, Awkward Age, those are just, for me, very hard books. And to completely understand them, almost on a sentence level, takes a lot of work, and I do need to go back and reread.
And so now that you are immersed in contemporary literature, right, do you miss that experience?
I don't miss it. I'm really glad that I had it, and I think someday I hope that that cycles back around again. But I also realize that I was limiting myself by reading the books that I was positive were the best books. And now that I can read, Louise Erdrich's La Rose and Jane Hamilton's The Excellent Lombards and Liz Strout's My Name is Lucy Barton and Paul Kalanithi's When Breath Becomes Air, right, and Susan Faludi's In the Dark Room. This has been the most amazing year. Lab Girl, Hope Jaron, Jacqueline Woodson, Another Brooklyn. All of these books are just so good, and it would break my heart to think that I could have missed them.
All on my NPR podcast.
Really?
Can I just say that?
Really?
You've just validated my career.
No, I'm the Susan...
Or my
okay,
year.
Wait, hang on. The
okay,
Susan,
not Susan Faludi. No,
okay,
I just made a mental note to go.
But
Louise, who's here.
Oh, God, that book.
And
that's
Hope Jaron.
My favorite Louise
book ever.
Where is Louise?
Do you think... Should we out her in the audience?
Louise, best somewhere? Ever. And everyone in the dark is like, she's here in the dark. Let me just say, I talk about these books, and I can't find people who are reading In the Dark Room.
Why?
I have no idea. Susan Faludi, In the Dark Room, masterpiece.
Everybody's writing this down. Everybody's got their phones out making notes.
And it's interesting because it was a book, probably I had three copies of it in my office. People had sent me the galleys. I looked at it. I thought, I don't have any interest in this at all. And then I read the review. It was a front page Times review on Father's Day, which was weird. And I thought, I'm going to give this a try. And it's jaw-dropping. I mean, it's one of those books that you think, no matter what happens with Susan Faludi, she's never going to top this.
Wow.
This book is genius. So I'll tell you what it's about.
Okay.
So Susan Faludi, famous, probably the most famous American feminist after Gloria Steinem, won a Pulitzer, wrote Backlash, had a violent and bullying father. Her parents get divorced when she's in high school. She loses touch with her father, hasn't heard from him in 25 years. He goes back to Hungary, where he's from. She gets an email. He's 75 years old, saying, just checking in, wanted to see how you're doing. Some things have changed. My name is Stephanie now. Thought maybe you'd want to write a book about me. And it's not even what the book's about. Her father transgendered at 75, and it becomes a book about the Holocaust and about the Nazis in Hungary and her father's experience and how it impacted their lives in ways she never knew about and led him to this decision. It's incredible.
On the list. You're a very no-nonsense kind of person.
It's been mentioned.
Has it?
Yeah. Especially by my mother and my husband.
Has it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is your mother... when we were talking in the green room, you were telling me that she's very beautiful.
She is.
And that people automatically assume that she's a narcissist.
Right.
Because of that.
Exactly. And she's not. She's a really nice person.
And you've thought about what it means to grow up with a very beautiful mother?
Yes, I have.
And what does that mean?
You know, I think it's obviously different for different people, but for me it was great. I remember thinking when I was very young, that's not a game you're going to win. So you might as well go for smart.
The game being... The game being,
Well, I mean, it's not a competition, but But it was always going to go to mom. The eyes were always going to go to mom. The eyes are still going to mom. And that's fine. But when, I mean, it's great, as well they should. But when I was very young, I thought, okay, beauty isn't where I'm going to put my chips. Because I think no matter what I look like, I was always going to be overshadowed by my mother's beauty. Again, rightfully so. Like, I'm not crying in my cups over this. But I also could see the problems inherent with being beautiful. And it just didn't seem like a great plan. But being smart, being successful, seemed like a much better plan.
What happens when you decide, so the chips are going to be on being smart? How do things change?
You start rereading Henry James. Well, and I'm making it sound like some sort of a binary choice, like you could
be
smart or beautiful, which is not the case at all. My mother is smart and my mother is beautiful. But my mother certainly has gone through the world known for her beauty. I'm making this sound like a very big deal, and it actually oddly is a big deal. When I was a kid, every bag boy that they would fight a duel to take my mother's grocery bags out to the car and would always try to kiss her. The bag boys would try to kiss her.
Yuck.
Yeah, she couldn't have her phone number printed on her check because the guy at the liquor store would call her.
Wow.
Offer her free cases of wine.
She was also very nice, you said, right?
Very nice. Very nice. Still is. Nice and beautiful. My sister and I used to always say, oh, what's going to happen when mom isn't the most beautiful woman in the room anymore? And my mom is 79 and it is yet to happen. So we're just kind of figuring that this is the way it's going to be.
I don't want you to take this question the wrong way.
Lay it on me, Carrie.
I'm rethinking how to ask this.
You know what? Just
not
go
that
for
you're
it.
Not nice, but your mother invested in being nice, right? She probably spent time thinking about how to be nice. I think it's something that you cultivate. I don't know that a lot of people are just naturally nice.
You know, we could really have a long existential conversation about what it is to be nice, because in fact, I am extremely nice by my terms, which is, I am the most helpful person you would ever want to meet. If you are in trouble, I am the person you want to call. I have somebody living in my house probably 200 days out of the year. I am the person who makes the meals and brings the meals and picks you up at the airport and writes the checks. And I am very straightforward and no nonsense, but I am a great believer in good deeds, which goes back to, again, Catholic school and the nuns. It's really true. I was raised by the Sisters of Mercy. And this is it's an interesting thing. The Mercies were a very progressive order. There are about 8 of them left in the world, because the kind of women who would be Mercies no longer become nuns. You know, it's just, they're like very liberated nuns. And so my little nuns in Nashville are all in their 80s now, and they have spent their life visiting the sick and teaching children to read and doing for the poor and taking care of people and just being the embodiment of good deeds. And that is my idea of nice. It's my idea of religion. So I'm not the sweetest person
in
the world.
No, see, I wanted to know the answer, but I hesitated to ask the question because I'm not suggesting you're not nice.
No, and also I'm not sensitive. Which
that's great.
That's really good.
But so, you don't suffer fools.
No. Should I?
I don't think so.
Do you?
No.
There you go.
No.
That's
what
we
But I don't think
along.
People walk around going, she's really nice about me. And they probably don't say that about you
no.
at first blush.
No, they don't.
And it's interesting that that's something that your mother was so well known for.
People are also afraid of me. Are people afraid of you?
God, how did this turn into this? Yes.
As a matter of fact, they are.
But you can use that,
you
right?
You better believe it.
How do you use that?
I'll tell you how I use it. I am really good friends with a guy named Charlie Strobel in Nashville, who is a priest who runs the homeless shelter, the Campus for Human Development in Nashville. And it's so much more than a homeless shelter. And Charlie does all the good deeds, and he gets very worn out with the ask. And so he called me in one day and he said, help me come out. This is so painful. Help me write the speech for the fundraiser and help me figure out how I can ask people for money. People are so nice and they're so good and I don't want to take advantage of them. And I said, oh, I'll do it. Oh, not a problem.
I love that tone, too.
Not
oh,
a problem.
I'll do it.
I was like, I don't have to write it for you. Do you want to just sit in the audience and watch me wring money out of these people? And he said, oh, yes, I don't want to have to ask them for money anymore. This kills me. So what we do for the campus is we have a breakfast every 3 years. We say it's free to come in, but you have to pay to get out. And you have to make a three-year pledge. So this is how I am both nice and not nice. So I go up on the stage, and I'm thinking the theme to Jaws is pretty much playing as I'm walking across the stage, and everybody's kind of a tremble. And I said, listen, you've got two choices. You can be nice the way Charlie's nice. You can work with the homeless. You can come in and do the haircuts. You can teach the art classes. You can work at the foot clinic. I'm not working at the foot clinic. I am not that good. Therefore, I will salve my consciousness by writing a check. Those are your choices, friends. You can come and be a really, really fine human being and work at the foot clinic, or you can get out of that by writing me an enormous check.
Oh my gosh.
That's it. And I mean, people were like, ripping off their check and handing it up with shaky hands.
Wow. You should be running a country or something. I mean...
I use my power for good instead of evil.
Do you?
I really do.
Always.
I promote authors. I promote publishing. I help the poor. I really do. But in my wake, there are many frightened people. So sorry this is on radio. Like, this would really be hysterical if this was just a theater event.
No, this is great.
Yeah, for you.
Yeah. When do you think you really owned your power?
Do you know, I haven't really owned it all that long. There are several things missing in my brain, seriously. I read the Oprah book when it came out, the things I know for sure. You know what I'm talking about? That little bitty Oprah book. It came out maybe 2 years. By Oprah.
No, I haven't read that.
Little book. And I found it so fascinating because she talks about all of these problems that women have about shame and self-esteem and not feeling worthy. And I mean, I was reading it like some sort of anthropological text. I was thinking, really?
Who are these
Who
people?
Who are these women? I have never cared what people think of me. I hold myself to a high standard. I try always to do the right thing, but if people judge me, bad reviews, people saying not nice things, that's fine. That has never bothered me. Being the kid who was the last to be picked for volleyball, it just gave me more time to rest on the bleachers. I was not ripped up by it.
Yeah.
But... I, It really did come later in life that I started to think I have a kind of moral authority. You know, I'm successful. People like my books. People want to hear what I have to say. So why shouldn't I be saying, support your local library, give money to your homeless shelter, go support your local independent bookstore? Like, if people are coming to hang on my every word, why should I be talking about a book that they're probably going to read anyway, mine? why not fill up that airspace with something that was a little more powerful?
I was going to ask you about self-doubt. I mean, it doesn't sound like, and I'm not saying this jokingly, it does not sound like you have to cope much with self-doubt.
Two paths diverged in yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel them both, but being one traveler long, I mean, it doesn't make any difference. It's not like the choice is take my mother to lunch or commit murder. You know, it's why would there be a lot of place for self-doubt? I'm doing my best. I'm living my life. I am not curing cancer. I am not doing any major good. I am doing whatever I'm capable of doing, but I'm not going to do anything bad. I mean,
no, I didn't really mean self-doubt like that. You said you hold yourself to a high standard.
Okay, so what do you mean by self-doubt?
I mean,
what does self-doubt look like?
You said you hold yourself to a high standard. It doesn't sound like you spend a lot of time saying to yourself, am I fulfilling the kind of potential I know I have
as a
writer?
All right. Here's the secret to happiness. Take out your pencils. Low expectations.
I don't believe
dead,
that.
No. No, it is the truth.
I don't believe it.
It is the truth. When I was a child, I wanted to be a writer. The craziest thing I could possibly imagine would be to feed myself as a writer, to make $25,000 a year and live in an efficiency and not have health insurance. The idea that I could make a sustainable small living as a writer was the craziest thing that I could possibly come up with. Every single day I wake up and think, I shot the lights out. I have so exceeded my expectations for myself and everyone's expectations for me. I have done an amazing job with what I have. I am not the smartest person. I am not the most talented person. I am a really hardworking person. I am very, very good at focusing on my task. I don't sit around and think, wow, maybe I could have done something more with my life. Seriously?
No, that's not what I was suggesting. Let's bring the bellows out again.
Wait, I really want to know what you're suggesting.
No, I hear that. That makes a lot of sense. Many writers are not like you, and I'm in conversation, and they say there's still that there's still that thing on the horizon that I'm reaching for, that I always feel like I can get to, and that's what I'm working toward. And my big question of my life is whether I've got it to be able to fulfill that.
Art is such a privilege. Art is what you do when you have food and shelter and your family is safe. When everything is so fine that you have extra time, you make art. My life is such a privilege. Everyone's fine. And there is nothing else. If I never wrote another word, it has been a beautiful ride. And I'll tell you, if I had real courage, I would probably spend my life working at the homeless shelter. I would probably do the foot clinic. I'm serious. Mm-hmm. That seems closer to the Holy Grail to me than another book. And I'm not that brave. Or that nice.
This How about
has been
another?
The craziest interview I have ever done in my life. I
Good.
Love
Mission
this.
Accomplished.
Wow.
Same here.
Carrie Miller's Talking Volumes event was held last week at the Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul, and Patchett's new novel is called Commonwealth. This is NPR News Presents.